You know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Professor Jacob L. Wright, author of the important new book, Why the Bible Began. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish Radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Sukkot Sameach, Moadim L'Simcha. That's right. Now that the High Holy Days are completed and we've experienced the full Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur experiences, naturally the Jewish calendar has launched us immediately into another major holiday called Sukkot. This is a time of great joy for Jews. Today is the second day of the Feast of Tabernacles or Booths, Sukkot, which is actually my favorite Jewish festival, in part because it is not Yom Kippur. I love Sukkot because of the outdoor quality, the emphasis on family, friends, guests, and enjoying life, and on its central theme of gratitude, which underlies much of what is best about religion in general and Judaism in specific. Sukkot's the 8-day-long harvest festival commemorating a holiday that's one of the truly ancient ones on our complex Jewish calendar. In biblical times, Sukkot, called Sukkot in Yiddish and in Ashkenazic Hebrew, was referred to as Hechag, the holiday, as though it were the only one, and likely it was the most observed of all festivals ordained in the Torah. Sukkot is the Jewish harvest festival during which we build tabernacles, little huts outside the house that we decorate with fruits and vegetables and in which we eat and even sleep over the course of the holiday. It's called Zman Simchatenu, the time of our joy. It's filled with food, friends, and music, as well as rituals that pay tribute to our reliance upon God for the many good things in our lives. Sukkot is the Jewish Thanksgiving, and in fact, the American holiday of Thanksgiving is based by the Puritan fathers on the biblical Feast of Tabernacles, or Feast of Booths, established in the Torah. It was particularly important for our Israelite ancestors whose entire lives were connected to agricultural production, farming, herding, tending orchards and vineyards. A good harvest meant a healthy, safe, well-fed winter. It was something for which to be truly grateful. The reason Sukkot was most observed of all ancient Jewish festivals, likely because it came at the right time of year. While the Torah specifies 3 separate pilgrimage festivals in which the ancient Israelites were to travel to Jerusalem to make offerings to God, Passover in the spring, Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks in early summer, and Sukkot in the autumn, there must have been major challenges to farmers inherent on walking to Jerusalem for the first 2 of these. Springtime, when Passover occurs, is a time of planting, weeding, fertilizing, doing all the hard work that will eventually result in a good crop. Early summer, when Shavuot falls, is time of the first fruits and the early barley crop, which must be harvested. But there are still many other crops growing that need to be tended in the diverse Mediterranean agriculture of Israel. But Sukkot comes in the fall, the autumn, when all the crop yields are complete and the harvest is in. It's a time of plenty and was an easier time to take a week to travel to the capital and celebrate. Sukkot must have been when the greatest crowds of Israelites arrived in Jerusalem, bringing agricultural bounty, making sacrificial offerings, but enjoying feasts every night of the festival. The temporary huts they erected, the Sukkot they built, would have been much like the huts that they used when they stayed in the fields near the crops they were harvesting. It was a time of great joy and celebration, of beautiful weather, of food and drink and conviviality. And it still is. Sukkot is the time when you're commanded to invite guests to your own sukkah, which reflects on the very structure of a sukkah. It is usually open on at least one side so that visitors see immediately that they are welcome. In addition to the ritual commandments of sitting in the sukkah, actually dwelling in the sukkah technically, and waving the lulav and etrog, the four species with which we celebrate the festival, palm, willow, myrtle, and citron, that symbolize the agricultural nature of the holiday, we also complete the great commandment of hachnasat orchim, welcoming guests. Even luminaries from the Jewish past are invited, called ushpizin. Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Rachel and Leah, and so on. Everyone, even our deep, dark ancestors, are supposed to enjoy Sukkot. There's a lovely little Yiddish tune about a sukkah called Asukkale by the oddly named duo of Suki and Ding.
Asukkale, a kleine. Reitalach gemeine Hab ich mir a sikele gemach Badechtem dach Mit a bissel eschach Sitz ich mir in sikele Doch die Spalten in die Lechterlech sei löschen sich viel. Es ist mir achidisch, wie ich mach mir kiddisch. In die Lechterlech sei brennen.
That was the pretty song Asukkale for the Holiday of Booths. We're on the second day of Sukkot right now. By the way, in Europe, there were homes built with a room with a retractable roof that could be turned into a kind of interior sukkah for the festival, an inside-the-house hut. By Jewish law, a sukkah cannot have more than two permanent walls, so these interior sukkahs made some accommodation by constructing extra walls inside the house. It speaks to the level of commitment to this wonderful holiday and to being Jewishly observant that entire homes were designed with a sukkah used just 8 days a year in mind. Our guest on Too Jewish this morning is biblical scholar Jacob L. Wright of Emory University, who has written a stunning book about the origin of the Bible that resets the whole way we look at the foundational text of Western civilization. Meet Professor Wright when he joins us for a great visit here in just a moment on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
This Is Judaism offers everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. Who is Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? What do Jews believe about life after death? In three fun, inexpensive, informative sessions, This Is Judaism brings you the joy of Jewish life and learning. You'll study with Rabbi Sam Kohan and learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about. Plus, you can get a sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are at the Tucson JCC, the J, and are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, This Is Judaism is completely free, but the learning is invaluable. Want to know what your new Jewish relatives are all about? Want your kids to understand Jewish heritage, history, and holidays? Want to try some delicious Jewish food? Then This Is Judaism is for you. There's no charge, but you must pre-register by calling 520-276-5675. Visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or email rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. This Is Judaism is taught on three consecutive Sunday afternoons in September and October at the Tucson JCC. There's a free Zoom option, but registration is required. All classes are with Rabbi Sam Kohan. Remember, there's no obligation, and registration is completely free for this wonderful introduction to Jewish life. Register for This Is Judaism by calling 520-276-5675. It's the most effective introduction to Jewish learning and life ever. For your very own entry or return to Judaism, visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, Jacob Wright. He's professor of biblical scholarship, associate professor of Hebrew Bible at Emory, the chair of the Hebrew Bible in the Graduate Division of Religion. He has taught at University of Heidelberg, is an expert on biblical archaeology, the weaponry of biblical times, and his new book, which is both groundbreaking and fascinating, is called Why the Bible Began. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Rabbi Cohen.
So what prompted this kind of more global look at the Tanakh?
Yeah. So you said I do weaponry, and that is one aspect of my research. But what really drove me to look at anything in terms of material culture and arrowheads and stuff that I study has always been a much grander picture. And that is, what impact did war have on the society of ancient Israel? And that's when I got a National Endowment for the Humanities award, a fellowship for a year, to really write that book. And notice the impact on ancient Israelite society. In the time when I went to Israel and sat down to write that, my interest shifted, and I think rightly, to a different aspect of war. Rather than the impact on society, that would be technology and the way fortifications are built, water systems, communication systems, and what have you, I'm still interested in those. I'm very interested in ancient material culture and life. The real issue, I think, that has to be central to all of our concerns for those who read this Tanakh and who love it and who study it and have a difficult relationship with it or whatever, is the impact of war on the formation of a new concept of peoplehood. So the impact of war on society is technology and what have you, political institutions, but the impact of defeat on the very destruction of that society, thanks to generations of anonymous scribes who we really know very little about, thanks to them, we have a new concept of what it means to be a people. It was a question that had never really been asked. Everybody knew what a kingdom was, or a city, or a tribe, but a people? What's a people? And that, for me, is the heart, the central question that connects all of Tanakh together. It can't be Torah, because then you have the book of Esther.
Right.
But you know what is central to Esther? Peoplehood. How can we be a people, even in diaspora? And that's the central question that begins already in Bereishit, in Genesis, and it runs throughout the Tanakh like a red thread.
You know, it's a fascinating point. And when you think about the Tanakh, it's people think about it, oh, it's the Bible, or as Christians call it, the Old Testament. But the truth is, it's a complicated body of literature that isn't even necessarily tied together by God, which, as you mentioned, Esther doesn't mention God. Neither really does the book Song of Songs. So what are they doing in there? Well, they're connecting us in these really remarkable ways. We will talk much more. That was the teaser part of the interview, everybody, with Professor Jacob Wright about his book, about the Bible, kind of maybe the best book written about the Bible in a while, called Why the Bible Began, when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in Northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a fabulous array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, bar and bat mitzvah, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat Sukkot services and Shabbat services in general, or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in person. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. It's time to get those kids to Hebrew school. Religious school is open now for school-aged children or grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Our services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us at Beit Simcha in person Friday night, 6:30 p.m. Shabbat services. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. Services are at 10 a.m. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, and you can also join us virtually on Facebook. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, and our musical services are in person and virtually always. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those. Go to Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available right now. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, Sukkot, Simchat Torah, Yizkor, our great religious school, Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, a lot of them taught by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, as our services are conducted by me. You can go to any of them in person and on Facebook or Zoom. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org for more information, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing, most dynamic Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18 at gmail.com. That's T-O-O, JewishRadio18 at gmail. Or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, 2JewishRadio.com, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as podcasts, very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review 2 Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments certainly help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs. in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470 to speak to a family advisor at Evergreen. Call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And Chag Sameach.
Gam Lecha.
The Jewish community of Ukraine has tremendous history, but it's a little surprising, I think, to people in America to realize that there are still actually a lot of Jews in Ukraine in the midst of this war, and that it's still a significant Jewish community.
Absolutely. We talked a little bit about this when the war first broke out, when the Russians invaded Ukraine, with no provocation and no justification whatsoever. And there are a couple of things that come to mind. One is apparently a lot of the world, and especially a lot of Americans, don't understand that allowing this war to be prosecuted the way it is by the Russians puts the security of every independent nation in jeopardy, because this cannot stand, basically. And it affects and makes nervous a lot of nearby countries in particular. But also, even countries like Chile worry that, you know, if this kind of raw aggression goes unchecked and unpunished, who could be next? And who would be the next aggressor? All kinds of countries worry about this, and we should be worried too, not that we're going to be invaded or attacked necessarily, but that our image in the world as the defender of freedom and democracy is now at peril, and at greater peril than it's been any time since World War II. So that's one thing that comes to mind, not specifically Jewish. We'll get to that in a minute. The other thing that's much more specifically Jewish is very recent news out of Canada, where when Zelensky visited Canada, there was an address to Parliament. And during that address, some staffer just obviously failed to do their homework. They honored and gave a standing ovation to a Ukrainian quote-unquote war hero who was actually part of the Waffen-SS and right. fought for the Nazis.
And was involved in atrocities against probably Jews and Poles and who knows whom else.
Right. For sure. And this is both a narrow problem and a broad problem. The broad problem is that in a lot of countries on the fringes of Russia and what used to be the Soviet Union, like the Baltic states, Belarus, Ukraine, whatever, people who were honored as patriots in the war, World War II, frequently fought with or on behalf of the Nazis and committed atrocities against their fellow countrymen, and particularly against those of their fellow countrymen who were Jewish. And there's a real tension in places like Lithuania and Latvia and Ukraine about, do you honor these guys as patriots? And what about the ones who then resisted being swallowed up by Russia into the former Soviet Union? Or do you recognize them for what they were, which is war criminals? So that's a broader question. The narrow question is, you know, the best photo op, apparently, of Zelensky's whole visit to Canada was when the members of parliament gave a standing ovation to this war criminal. And immediately Trudeau apologized and everybody fell all over themselves to say this was a horrible oversight. We're taking steps to make sure it'll never happen again. And the Speaker of the Parliament took responsibility and resigned.
He resigned, yeah.
Even though, I mean, it's not really his job to do this kind of homework, but it's his job to choose staffers who will.
Yeah.
And he came under tremendous fire from the entire Canadian Jewish community and from Jewish communities around the world. So that's a piece of very recent news. Now we'll get probably next week to the Ukrainian Jewish community today and historically.
Thanks so much, Tom. I mean, very complicated. It's always complicated in that part of the world, isn't it?
Right.
We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie new, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Two bees run into each other. The first bee asks the other bee how things are going. Really terrible, says the second bee. The weather's been really wet, damp, there aren't any flowers or pollen, I can't make any honey. No problem, says the first bee. Just fly down 5 blocks, turn left, keep going till you see all the cars. There's a bar mitzvah going on, there are all kinds of fresh flowers and fruit. Thanks for the tip, says the second bee, and he flies off. A few hours later, the two bees run into each other again. The first bee asks, how did it go? Great, says the second bee. It was everything you said it would be. "What's that on your head?" asked the first bee. "Oh, that's my yarmulke," says the second bee. "Why are you wearing a yarmulke?" asked the first bee. And the second bee answers, "I didn't want them to think I was a wasp." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Old. I told you old. A special feature of Too Jewish. Just for you, you should live and be well. Now a word of Torah. This Shabbat, we read the special reading for the festival of Shmini Atzeret, the eighth day of Sukkot. Technically, it's a separate holiday in its own right, although really it's the last day. Sukkot is an agricultural festival rich in ritual. The observances for Shmini Atzeret include chanting Hallel, special festival service of praise, reciting Yisker memorial prayers for the dead, and the unique Tfilat Geshem, the blessing for rain. The prayer for rain is chanted to a beautiful melody that is only used one other time of the year, on the festival of Pesach, when we pray for dew, tal, connecting us to the natural world and God's creation of it through prayer and song. The Torah reading on the Shabbat morning of Shmini Atzeret is shared with Passover and Shavuot and includes the rites of the pilgrimage festivals in biblical times. Then, next Saturday night, on this holiday of Simchat Torah, the celebration of Torah, which completes our complex fall festival cycle, we'll finish the Torah with the last portion of Deuteronomy, the death of Moses, and begin to read the Torah all over again, chanting the opening passages of Genesis and the gorgeous narrative of the creation of the universe. This is a period of abundance in both harvest foods and Torah readings. But there is one special additional reading on this festival that is not from the Torah itself, but from the latter stages of the Bible, the Ketuvim writings, Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, the biblical book chanted on the Shabbat of Sukkot, or this year on Shmini Atzeret, is perhaps the single most beautiful piece of literature ever. Succinct, poetic, gorgeous, wise. It includes famous phrases that have become part of our language, including, "The sun also rises. There is nothing new under the sun. All rivers run to the sea, but the sea is not full. For everything there's a time and season for every purpose under heaven. The earth returns to the dust that it was, but the spirit returns to God who gave it all." Quotes from Kohelet, Ecclesiastes. The conclusion of Ecclesiastes is simple but powerful. After a poetic exploration of wisdom and folly, a survey of what the whole world has to offer, the author of Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, says, "The conclusion of the matter, all having been heard, is to revere God, keep the mitzvot, for that makes the complete human being." As autumn approaches, Kohelet reminds us that much of what we do is vanity, vapor. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Hevel havalim, akol havel, the book begins, and compels us to realize that God is our true source of meaning, beauty, purpose. At this joyous time of year, it's a sobering but magnificent reminder of what really matters. Even, perhaps especially at seasons of joy, we need to remember that our greatest success comes from our integrity. When we return in a moment, our guest this morning, Professor Jacob Wright, tells us what the Bible really is in our great discussion and how his new book explores that. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israel's Supreme Court last week heard a challenge to a law that makes it harder to remove a sitting prime minister, a law designed to protect Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has been working to reshape the entire justice system while on trial for corruption. The hearing is part of several pivotal court challenges against a proposed package of legislation and government moves meant to alter the country's justice system. It comes after months of turmoil in Israel over the plan. It deepens a rift between Netanyahu's government and the judiciary, which it wants to weaken to irrelevance despite unprecedented opposition. Last week's hearing, the second by the High Court, took place in front of an expanded 11-judge panel, underscoring the importance of the deliberation. relations. Netanyahu's governing coalition, Israel's most right-wing and nationalist and religious ever, passed an amendment known as the Incapacitation Law back in March, allowing a prime minister to be deemed unfit to rule only for medical or mental health reasons, that is, not corruption. Under the amendment, only the prime minister or government has the power to determine the prime minister's unfitness. The previous version of the law was vague about both the circumstances in which a prime minister could be deemed unfit, as well as who had the authority to declare him so or her so. But experts say the amendment expressly strips the attorney general, who historically wields the power to declare a prime minister unfit for office, of the ability to do so. The current attorney general, Gali Baharav Miara, told Netanyahu he was violating conflict of interest agreements that he had made. But she has not indicated that she will move towards declaring him unfit because of that. Critics say the law protects Netanyahu from being deemed unfit for office over claims he violated the conflict of interest agreement by dealing with a legal overhaul while he is on trial for corruption charges. They also say the law is tailor-made for Netanyahu and encourages corruption. Based on those criticisms, last week's hearing focused on whether the law should come into effect after the next national elections and not immediately, so that it isn't interpreted as a personalized law for Bibi. A ruling is expected by January. Wow, okay. We are trying to repeal the undemocratic and unconstitutional statute which allowed an unfit and improper prime minister to remain in his position. Actually, they built him a kind of golden cage so that he will be protected from justice, said Eliad Shraga, chairman of the Movement for Quality Government in Israel, which is challenging the amendment before the court. Ahead of the hearing, dozens of protesters gathered outside Netanyahu's private home in Jerusalem, chanting democracy, while his allies defended the law. Simcha Rothman, a main driver of the overhaul of the judiciary, told Israeli Army Radio that the court's decision to hear the case was harmful to Israeli democracy, and challenging the law was akin to throwing out the results of a legitimate election. I'm not sure. Maybe he thinks it should be a permanent election of Bibi. The moment the court determines the laws, then it is also the legislative branch, the judiciary, and the executive branch, he said. This is an undemocratic reality. No, it's called checks and balances. The government wants to weaken the Supreme Court and limit judicial oversight, saying it wants to return power to elected lawmakers and away from what it sees as a liberal-leaning interventionist justice system. The first major piece of the overhaul was passed in July. An unprecedented 15-judge panel began hearing arguments on it earlier this month. The drive to reshape Israel's justice system, well, to, I don't know, destroy it, comes as Netanyahu's trial for corruption is ongoing. He is charged with fraud, breach of trust, and accepting bribes in three separate cases involving influential media moguls and wealthy associates. He denies wrongdoing, seeing the charges as a witch hunt against him orchestrated by a hostile media and a biased justice system. Experts and legal officials say a conflict of interest arrangement struck after Netanyahu was indicted was meant to limit his involvement in judicial changes. After the incapacitation law was passed in the spring by his government, Netanyahu said his hands were no longer tied, he wasn't bound, and he was taking a more active role in the legal changes. That sparked a rebuke from the Attorney General, Baharav Miara, who said Netanyahu's remarks and any further actions were completely illegal and conflict of interest. Critics say Netanyahu and his government are working to upend the country's delicate system of checks and balances and are setting Israel on a path toward autocracy. Well, they kind of are. The overhaul has plunged Israel into one of its worst domestic crises, deepening long-standing societal divisions between those who want Israel to be a Western-facing liberal democracy and those who want to emphasize the country's conservative and religious character. Netanyahu has moved forward with the overhaul despite a wave of opposition from the majority, a broad swath, frankly, of Israeli society, Top legal officials, leading economists, and the country's booming tech sector have all spoken out against the judicial changes, which have sparked opposition from hundreds of military reservists who say they will not serve so long as the overhaul remains in play. Tens of thousands of people have protested every single Saturday for 9 months. The largest of these protests has attracted hundreds of thousands, in a country of 8 million, by the way, amazing, of pro-democracy Israelis opposing Netanyahu's raid on the judiciary and Bibi's kind of fascistic attack on the balance of power in Israel. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Professor Jacob Wright is the Associate Professor of Hebrew Bible at Emory University. He's the Chair of Hebrew Bible in the Graduate Division of Religion, taught at the University of Heidelberg, has written extensively on a variety of biblical subjects, biblical archaeology, biblical weaponry. His new book is called Why the Bible Began, and it's a remarkable and I think a very important book about Tanakh. In evaluating, you mentioned in the beginning part of the show about the concept of, let's call it Am Yisrael, the peoplehood of Israel, that's kind of woven all through the Bible. Really, in the Bible, though, there are more than one people involved, right? Between the division between Judah and Israel. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. I just want to add a little caveat before I start. I am no longer the chair.
Oh, sorry.
My esteemed colleague is the chair. I just need to set that straight. That's probably in somewhere. And I took a leave and passed the baton gladly. But we talked about defeat in the first little episode, a little part of our conversation, and the impact of war on the making of a new concept of peoplehood. But now you've asked a question that is the second pillar of this book. It's not just defeat. Defeat is the major thing, admitting defeat instead of denying it. I want to come back to that if we want to, because it's a really...
Well, it's incredibly important. You know, like, in fact, if we didn't lose, maybe we wouldn't be around. And you make that point really tellingly. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So we'll come back to that in a second. But the second part is another, not defeat, but also division. There was this thing which really resonates with us, perhaps, as Americans, North and South, literally the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom. And one was in the North and the South, and they were divided. And the parallels are not really, I don't want to pursue them in relation to American history. It's a very different thing. But the notion at the heart of this, and it's not just with the U.S. history, it's also North and South Korea, East and West Germany, and so forth, is when a people who consider themselves to be a people but are divided by political borders, and you have that going on in Burma and India. I have a student in my class who was telling us about that just yesterday. So that poses the question, if we're divided by two kingdoms, are we just the citizens of those kingdoms? Or is there something deeper that connects us as a people transcending those borders? Now, it goes to the heart of the critical understanding of the formation of Scripture that I'm presenting, and I'm building on the work of others and taking it in new directions. But I would begin by saying that the idea that there was a people transcending these two borders is a long process. It wasn't really there at the beginning. You would have many different kinds of clans developing in 1,000 different directions if it were not for a kingdom of the north. Really, the Omrites were vilified. Ahab and Jezebel, remember them? They're vilified, but they built this big, strong northern kingdom. And it wasn't that there's a people who understood themselves as Israelites from time immemorial, and that half of them got included in this kingdom and half of them got included in Judah, but rather that you have the relationship, first of all, political between the northern kingdom and its Judahite southern, very much smaller neighbor, which it really kind of dominated for much. But you have this inheritance, is building on Daniel Fleming's from NYU work, that there's an inheritance of Judah after the northern kingdom is defeated. So you really, we talk about defeat and division, but there are two defeats and they map on to the division. The northern kingdom is defeated first. We forget that, around 722. And it was them who started the idea of, and it was they, I should say, that started the idea that our kings are gone, but you know what, we're still a people. And it was this northern idea. They didn't really build it to the proportions that we have it today. That was after 587 and the years directly preceding it. We hear from the book of Jeremiah as people knew, saw the writing on the wall, we're going down, just like our northern neighbor went down a century and a half before. And what really is fascinating about that century and a half, those 130 years, the long 7th century we call it, is Hezekiah. About two decades after the northern kingdom falls, Hezekiah is a famous king within our history of Judah, David and then Hezekiah and Josiah, right? But Hezekiah...
Yeah, the only kings who seem to actually believe in God, you know, the one God. It's fascinating. He just...
Yeah, and we found his seal, and interestingly, his personal seal has an Ankh on it, the Egyptian symbol for life. But let's not get on...
Let's not go too far afield here, okay.
We'll have to come back and talk about that. But the thing is that Hezekiah is now king of Judah. The north is wiped out. The Assyria is on the warpath towards Judah, and he loses a major city. It's not really made much. It's not even told about in Tanakh, in the book of Malachi Kings. But Lachish, we know from the palaces that you can see, the reliefs of these palaces from Nineveh that you can see in the British Museum, most dramatic things, the first depictions of Judeans being taken into captivity.
Into slavery.
We see mothers and fathers and children. And it was during that time that one of the major cities fell, but Hezekiah nevertheless escaped unscathed. So Jerusalem, not unscathed, I should not put it that, but he still had Jerusalem. And what happened in that long century was that there were people within Jerusalem who said, we are the city of God. Just as we were saved from the Assyrians at that time, we will be saved also in this time. And that's what Jeremiah and others were up against. Quit believing that, excuse my French, BS. Let us bend our necks to the yoke of Babylon and live. And some call him a collaborator. But what is really at the center of it is that we're people who have a future. And just as Israel from the north, their history showed that they, the idea after defeat, there can be something new. We're going to take it to a new level. And that's what happened with the making of the Bible.
So I have to ask you, this is maybe a sidetrack, maybe not. Speaking about Hezekiah, my son and I study Tanakh together once a week. We just read the end of 1st Isaiah, and there's that strange incident where the Babylonian emissaries, who are basically spies, come, and he shows them everything. And Isaiah says, what are you doing? And then he says, well, it's okay, because even though my children will be carried off into captivity, we'll have peace in our time. Sounds like Neville Chamberlain.
Yes. I named that, I did deal with that very line from him in a prominent place in the book.
Yes.
On the beginning to Hezekiah's chapter. The most cynical and awful verse perhaps in all of Tanakh.
It's terrible.
It's okay, in my time at least we'll have peace.
Yeah.
And it's such a sentiment that we have with the all kinds of things going on across the globe, from the environment to politics. I'm okay with mine. It's going to be okay in my time, but future generations, what we don't know what will happen.
Yeah, après moi la deluge, you know, like it's okay. It doesn't matter if the flood comes after I'm gone.
That's it, just always gets me as like, that's got to be the deepest point right there. And it's so typical for all of us too, just to like think about, well, at least I'll have
the survival of the people after the destruction of the first temple, far from guaranteed. Every nation around Israel that had been conquered by the Babylonians, by the Assyrians, was gone, basically. Many of the ones conquered by the Babylonians disappeared into history. What are the unique qualities that the Bible highlights that keep this particular people from disappearing?
Yeah, that's a good question. Coming back to that first factor, defeat. So division, but also defeat. And the Judean authors really made a lot from defeat. And in some cases, we can see that it was actually women in Judah, these professional lamenters, mekonot, these who are, they're they were officially professionals, you know, who lamented death.
Right.
But they also then lamented the destruction of Judah. And they really made, as so often throughout the Mediterranean world, we women who are making kind of how things are interpreted and their lamenting of this really, I think, reinforced this attention to defeat. And what happens in the making of the Bible is something very peculiar in the writing of historical narratives. We have historical narratives before the Bible. They didn't invent them. We have narratives, though, always told from the perspective of the palace. And it's usually along the lines of, before me, things were really rough. I rose, and things are really swell now. And that's how so many stories end, right? From in our, even today, something bad, and then the Hollywood happy ending, and oh, wow, great.
Right.
Well, what happens in Tanakh?
Everybody lived happily ever after.
Everybody lived, but that's, in a certain sense, what happens within the Bible, but in a very inverted way. So we have the golden period at the beginning, and then along comes David and so forth, but it's downhill from there. And the focus is at the very end of this narrative that begins with the creation of the world in Genesis 1. It ends in 2 Kings 25 with the destruction of Jerusalem and the exile of the population. And that's the end of that entire massive, elaborate monument to defeat, not monuments to victory that are now left in the sands of time. So you have to ask the question, well, why everybody was defeated? Why did a Bible emerge from this defeat of people? Why did they admit defeat? Maybe women, the lamenters, are a big factor. There are many factors, but the division in terms of the northern kingdom already experienced this conquest and defeat, and the new thought that came out of that is a big part of it. But what must also be really emphasized is that Judah and Israel are small kingdoms, and they knew that they were never going to be the Ninevehs, the Assyrian, Babylonian, Egyptian empires of the world. So they always had a smaller consciousness. It was David and Goliath consciousness, which goes to the heart of a Judean underdog identity. So they had this idea that we need to have a plan B, because the likelihood is we're going to get conquered. We're on this land bridge connecting Mesopotamia to Egypt, and we're going to get in the way. So there always was survival strategies among these populations, because they lived in harm's way, and that's why a lot of them moved up into the hill country of Jerusalem, which was actually out of the way and really the most off the beaten path place in the ancient world, maybe overstated. But what happens with is that the Judean authors, in response to their defeat, start to embrace this consciousness and say, we're going to make this the moment, the turning moment, in which instead of denying this and focusing on the heroes of the past and trying to relive that and perhaps aspire to a time where we're going to have a new David, let's push that off way into the future to a God knows who, when kind of time, and focus in the present on things that are going to really strengthen us. And that's to answer your question. What are the things that are embedded in this monument to defeat and then the literature that develops around them, around it? The prophets and the Psalms and so forth. What is all of that about? It's about what I would call a curriculum. It's really the literature to ask what it means to be a people, and it's a literature built for the people themselves. And that's a very distinctive thing in the ancient Near East. We have a lot of texts. Very few of them, though, have any kind of quality that is this kind of corpus for a families, for readers of all kinds to, you know, the story of Ruth about a mother and her two sons, and they go away and then the sons die and they come back. I mean, that kind of literature is very distinctive. And it's an attention to the lives of people, because they understood that we can't focus on the lives of our heroes, because that's wishful thinking. What we need in the present is an educated, informed, text-focused kind of identity that can replace the identity wrapped up around the throne, around a native kind of state, a kingdom that's going to perhaps never be reestablished. So these scribes who are writing texts for themselves for many generations have the idea that these texts can become sense. They don't have to be in the shadows of our scribal chambers. They can be at the center of society. And you know that scene in which Ezra, the people call Ezra to come and bring the Sefer Torah, the Torah.
Yeah, and read it out loud because we don't know what's in there.
Coming from Babylon.
Right.
It's like, I describe that as a rock concert. The people are wanting text, give us the Torah, bring it. And Ezra comes and he brings the Torah and they all cry and they fall down and they go away and they make merry and so forth. What is that? That is the vision of scribes who worked among themselves and had a technology that was, we take it for granted today that everybody reads text, but that's only because of the work of scribes like them throughout history who have done this, and that is have a vision that text that they love could be loved by a larger population of people out there, that there could be a reading public. And they imagine the scene in which the people want that text. They can't read it themselves, but they can have it read by Ezra and the Levites around them and others, and they can come back and study it. And that's their vision of, you know, portrait of Ezra as a rock star. And the concert is really, music that's playing is really this kind of, this whole performance of the Torah being
it's a perfect metaphor
and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I always think about King David as a rock star, but really, you're right. When Ezra brings it back and he's delivering it, by the way, don't you think scribes wrote that? Because who else would make Ezra the rock star of the whole Bible?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
That's exactly
where we see how they have this vision that there could be a public that longs for the Torah.
Well,
that's not probably the case at the time. That's still aspirational.
Yeah, absolutely.
It takes a long time in Jewish history until that's the case. And you hear from maybe you and your colleagues that it's still not enough to get.
It's not.
But it's a long ongoing process and doesn't really at all culminate in this moment that they construct for the purpose of saying, this is the ideal society. And
absolutely,
that's the ideal society that does not exist with a king of their own who lives in the shadow of an empire, but nevertheless has their texts, has their families, has their land, has their crops and their wine and the fig trees. And they are okay.
Jacob, I hope it happens for you. I hope they surround you as the rock star for your new book, Why the Bible Began. I feel like we could keep going for another 20 minutes. Tell us where people can find out more about you and more about the book.
Okay, well, the book comes out not until October 19th. It's out in Europe already, but on October 19th, it's available. You can pre-order it. Amazon might be the easiest way to pre-order.
Right.
I think it's around $30 right now.
Yep.
And you can find more about me just by Jacob Wright at Emory and reach out to me. I love hearing from people and I always answer emails. So thank you for bringing me on the show.
It's a great pleasure. We'll have to get you back again. Thank you so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Rosa Lowinger, author of the new book, Dwell Time, a memoir of art, exile, and repair. Join us at Congregation Beit Simcha every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. Shabbat services, Torah reading, and Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. And next Saturday night, join us for Simcha Torah, the wild, joyous celebration of Torah. Our playout this morning comes for the holiday of Sukkot, a joyous week of meals, friends, and outdoor joy. It's Benny Friedman singing Adi Ron's beautiful song, Ata HaKadosh, I am small but you, God, are holy, from the classic Sukkot film, Ushpizin. If you haven't seen it recently, find it online and watch it for Sukkot this year. It's still just great. My friends, Chag Sameach Moadim L'Simcha, Chagim Uzmanim L'Sason. A happy holiday of Sukkot. May you enjoy seasons of celebration and, of course, a Shavua Tov. A good week, a healthy week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
לא היססתי מלנגוס פה במעדן אחר. לא מצאנו את עצמנו, אין אותם לכחש. התרבות הזאת לא לנו, כי בליבנו יש מעני הקטן, השפל שבין כולם, ובתו נראה ונדאר. אני הקטן, האחרון שבעם, עומד או נרגע.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.